Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order at 1:04 p.m. Saturday, March 13th in the Max Grunberg Room in Alaska Capitol. Members present are in the room, myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, and Representative Story. I know Representative Eastman is in the vicinity and may soon join us in person, and then online we have Representatives Tarr and Klayman. So welcome, everyone. And we have a singular agenda item today, House Bill 55, relating to peace officer and firefighter retirement benefits. It's the famed defined benefits bill. And this is the first hearing of this legislation in this committee, this legislature. And it's my intent to entertain the introduction of the bill and sponsor remarks from staff and Representative Josephson. We have two pieces of invited testimony, and throughout the presentation, we also have the Deputy Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits online, Jim Puckett, for questions that the committee may have. And I'd like to keep today's hearing in the 75 to 90 minutes range, and no longer than that, ideally, just given that's a Saturday, but give us a good solid start and introduction to this meaty piece of legislation. So with that, we'll turn things over to Representative Josephson and staff for the bill introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17. It's the University Medical Center portion of Anchorage. With me is my staff, chief of staff, in fact, Elise Sorum-Burke, who has real expertise in this bill. And after I talk at a high level about the bill, she will give you more detail. And then we will have our invited testimony. So, and let me know if my mask makes my comments hard to decipher.
I'm deciphering every comment okay. So far.
So, in 2006, the legislature saw fit to end defined benefits for any person hired after the effective date of the legislation. For those who are interested, it might have been House Bill 141. But I can double check that. So there's been no new defined benefits for 15 years. At the time that we ended our relationship with new defined benefits, the unfunded liability, which for the listeners is that part that the state must make up, because as I'm sure you all know, these plans cannot be diminished. They are subject to constitutional protection. And by the way, that's what has created some understandable anxiety about returning to defined benefits. But Ms. Sorum-Burke and I, through the course of this, want to fully assuage people's concerns. So in that 15-year window, people have received a defined contribution. It is sometimes called a 401k, sometimes a 401A, sometimes a 403. These are all, I think, variations on the same model. And a defined contribution is something that is, at a vesting period in Alaska, it's 5 years, becomes portable. That is, you can take the employer's share along with your own share. And the amount contributed to that share, at least in Alaska, was pretty seriously reduced. You will see how the amount based on actuarial assessments of anticipated coverage of one's replacement of income is going to be in the low 30th percentile, so sort of 30 cents on a dollar. And under defined benefits, you typically can get closer, if not in excess of 50%. So, there have been efforts since 2006 to come back to a defined benefit. I would note that at the time, I interrupted myself, but at the time the deficit was, the unfunded liability was $11 billion. It's now about $6.5 billion. Mr. Chairman, that's partly because you and I and our colleagues at the time, about 5 years ago, put $3 billion into the fund all at once. And that was partly to reduce our annual requirements. The So we're back to this defined benefit concept. And because of the anxiety that I mentioned, our proposal is very much like the proposal in the 31st legislature under House Bill 79. When I say very much, it's essentially identical to that. Ms. Sorenberg can tell you about the smallest tweak that occurred. But basically, the plan is to start with first responders. These are corrections officers, they're troopers, they are small police departments, they are firefighters. I do not think it includes wildland firefighters. Ms. Sorenberg can explain how this cohort of workers is already treated separately, and so it's a good cohort to work with. But I think the other reason it's a good group to work with is that if people fear this is experimental, and again, I think when, at the end of our series of hearings, I think you'll be comforted that the math is very conservative, and so it does not result in an unfunded liability. But if people are concerned, the group we're talking about is, I'm doing this on memory, but I think it's about 1,400 people. So there are about 3,000 people that keep us safe in Alaska, and there are 1,400 who are younger, mostly, than the other 1,600. And so what this does to stay solvent, is, number one, unlike the first three tiers that lasted through from statehood through 2006, this tier may have to make a variable contribution depending on the returns to the ARM board. So it's going to be no less than 8%, but it could rise to 10%. And what that means is, during their active service, a person who chooses this plan, you're not required to take the plan, may actually see some diminishment in their actual paycheck. And that's designed to be implemented where the ARM board declares that the investment is less than 90% solvent. Typically, this would be a downturn in the stock market, but it could be other factors.
Representative Joseph, yes. So in effect, what you're describing is that in response to the threat of an emerging unfunded liability, there would be an increased employer or employee contribution that would take into effect, that would sort of auto-correct.
That's right. And presumably, if you got back to 100% for some period of time, the auto-correct would cease. And this would be, I think, largely up to the ARM board. But Ms. Sorenberg can take notes where I'm incorrect. The other thing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that this does is it only allows someone to, you can retire after 20 years of service, but you can't draw retirement until you're 55 under this plan. The plan is partly modeled after Washington State's return to a defined benefit, which has been very successful. And in fact, it was overfunded. And so Washington State said, we're going to move from age 55 down to age 53. Well, this bill doesn't speak to reducing to age 53, but a future legislature may see how successful this is and make those sorts of decisions. But at any rate, it requires 20 years of service for full retirement, but you must be 55 before you actually get a pension coming to your bank account. The bill also to sort of moderate the generosity of tier one and two and to a lesser degree three, it requires a look at the high 5 years of salary rather than the high three. It's another tool that is used to effectively moderate the plan. It also has a pension retirement adjustment, and that also, and again, I invite Ms. Sorenberg to clarify here, but that also, that is an inflation adjustment. So the ARM board can say inflation has been higher than normal, and state employees who are in defined benefit can be paid extra to bring them to parity with that inflation. Again, the PRPA, the post-retirement pension adjustment, can be reduced. At times, the ARM board finds that it has slipped to less than 90%. Finally, and this is one of the most important tools, it's an unfortunate tool, but it's a tool that we need in the toolbox in order to have a plan that won't burden, frankly, state and local government and therefore the people. And that is, the plan keeps a health retirement account just like Tier 4. It is 3% of a PERS salary. Now, this will be met with some consternation by some of the folks who want to come to Alaska or who are finishing high school or college and want to become troopers or firefighters. But this should come as no surprise to anyone, but that is the thing that has cost the most for governments to afford. And so it creates a health retirement account. We did a sort of a rough cut of what this might bring to somebody at retirement. It can be used simply to pay the fees of a provider, a doctor, or it can be used to purchase premiums. And so I've given you now four or five tools that we've identified that make the bill more affordable. Now, you might say, well, what's left? Why is this so affordable that it's unattractive? The answer is no, not nearly. In fact, you will hear at the first opportunity for a public hearing in the next hearing, if you invite us back. And by the way, we're grateful to take some of your Saturday and appreciate you hearing the bill. But you will hear a real outcry and clamor for this bill. And the reason is people are, they are being sort of persuaded and in fact are sort of being stolen away to other states that offer more generous plans. So what you're going to hear testimony of eventually is that you're going to hear about how there's this sort of graying sector who are in the age of, let's say, late 30s to mid 50s. And they are still here because they love Alaska and they have a defined benefit. Then you're going to hear about this younger cohort. They're going to be in sort of the 18, 19, 20 to late 30s group. And they're going to be in this Tier 4 range. And actually, let me take that back. This is the point I want to make. My only correction is when I said this late 30s group, it's really going to hear about sort of early to mid 30s. So it's that age group in between those who are receiving defined benefits and those who are receiving defined contributions that are being pulled away by our sister states. And so the problem with that is, and you're going to hear various numbers, but they're all going to be mostly in excess of $100,000 per recruit to train folks in towns like Sitka at the training academy for DPS. So this is a bill that we should look at as being unselfish in that we are being generous and offering a retirement one can live on, but it's also one government should look at selfishly and say, why are we training these fantastic officers and firefighters only to serve other communities? Bully for those other communities, but what about our citizens? So that's what this bill does, and I will let Ms. Soren Burke march through House Bill 55 in her PowerPoint, and we'll take any questions. If there are any for me right now, I can take a stab at them, but I will be using Ms. Soren Burke as a lifeline.
Yeah, let's take a quick intermission and see if there are questions from the committee given that high level overview. Questions from the committee representative, and actually before I go, I want to recognize Representative Kaufman and Eastman join us at 1:10, and I believe Representative Vance may be joining in due time. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Kreis Tompkins, through the chair, Representative Josephson. One thing you said was that this was optional. I thought the person had a choice at the beginning, and then all new recruits needed to, it wasn't an option, they needed to join with under the hybrid.
I'm going to go to Ms. Soren Burke on that.
Representative Story through the chair, for the record, Elise Soren Burke. You are correct. So there is an option, if this bill were to pass and this new tier of retirement were to go into effect for public safety individuals, there would be an option for individuals who are already in tier four to buy in, and they may opt not to, depending on, it will be much more attractive for, say, someone who's only been working a few years versus someone who's been working since 2006 to buy into the new tier. But anyone who comes in after this would go into effect would be part of the new tier.
Okay, okay. Thank you.
Apologies.
That's perfect.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And you don't have to necessarily have an answer now, but I'm curious, particularly on the question of inflation and inflation adjusting or inflation proofing, how does the current option stack up against the new option if there was to be high inflation?
Representative Eastman, I would like Mr. Puckett from the division to speak to that. Tier 4 doesn't have that kind of built-in mechanism, I don't believe, at all, but Tiers 1 through 3 do. And so it would be best if Mr. Puckett with the division was able to speak to that.
Mr. Puckett, if you heard the question, can you put yourself on the record and speak to Representative Eastman's question?
Yes, this is Jim Puckett, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement Benefits, through the chair to Representative, I believe it was Eastman. Tiers 1, 2, and 3 have a PRPA based on the CPI for the urban area of Anchorage, and statute gives us the formula that we use to make that adjustment, which is provided to the members on July 1 of each year. Tier 4 does not have a PRPA, and so this bill would be attractive to young peace officers, firefighters, because it does include a PRPA, and it's not a total inflation proofing, but it's a good percentage of it. And it is very beneficial to the retirees.
Follow up?
Yes, and I understand from reading about the bill that there's the option to sort of set aside or suspend the PRPA in this proposal. And I'm wondering if that set aside were to be enacted, how does the current Tier 4 compare with the hybrid if the PRPA is set aside?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, currently the Tier 4 does not have any PRPA provision at all. The new tier that would be implemented in this bill, the Armed Board would be able to make the decision to stop the PRPA if they found that the cost of the PRPA for the people in this new tier would make up more than 10% of the overall expense for the new PRPA to happen. At that time, it would be similar, not exactly the same, but it would be a similar benefit to those that are in the Tier 4.
Follow-up.
So just trying to contrast the attractiveness of the hybrid to the Tier 4 in that kind of environment, if there is high inflation and the inflation proofing is set aside, you said they're kind of similar. Is one clearly more attractive than the other? Is the hybrid still more attractive in that situation, or is the Tier 4 the more attractive?
Well, you have to understand, through the chair to Representative Eastman, you have to take into account that the Tier 4 is a defined contribution plan, and HB 55 would take those peace officers and firefighters that choose it and it put them back into a, that portion of it is a defined benefit pension. The attractiveness of a pension is everything is run by mathematical formulas. You work a certain amount of time, you have certain types of salaries, and you know when you retire what the amount of your monthly pension is going to be until for the rest of your life. Defined contribution, which, by the way, I'm a Tier 4 member, is a, we make our contributions, the employer makes the contributions, those go into your personal account, which you are totally in control of. You can invest it in a variety of different options. And then when you decide that you want to terminate whatever amount of money is in your account, then you're the one that makes decisions on how it's going to be handled during, if you want to call it that, your retirement years. So when I say that it's similar, if the ARM board determines that the PRPA for this tier in AB 55 need to be turned off, then they're similar in that they now don't, both of them, Tier 4 and the new tier, do not have any type of inflation catch-up provision going on at that time. They're not the same because one's a defined contribution, the other one would be a defined benefit on the payoff part of the bill.
Follow up.
And I'm just trying to consider if things do not go as we hope they would, and someone has entered the hybrid plan, is there a way for them ever to get back into the Tier 4 type of option?
It is an irrevocable decision for them if they decide that they join the new tier created by AB 55. That is an irrevocable decision.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? And I think at this point, if Representative Klayman or Tarr, feel free to just chime on in, since no visual cues here.
Thank you, Representative. It's Representative Klayman. I don't have any questions, but I appreciate the discussion.
All right. And Representative Tarr, feel free to chime in if you have a question. Otherwise, I think at this point, maybe we can turn it back to Ms. Soren Burke for more mid-altitude overview of the legislation.
Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins. Through, for the record, Elise Soren Burke, staff to Representative Josephson. So I will start with a sectional analysis of the bill. It is quite a lengthy bill, and the slide in front of you highlights some of the sections that implement the triggers Representative Josephson was referring to previously. So I will go through the whole bill, but I will be pausing to do a little bit more lengthy explanation on these sections. So Section 1 amends AS 37.10.202A regarding the powers and duties of the ARM board, and allows them to add new duties to account for appropriate employer contributions for the new tier, and also allows them to determine the amount of monthly employer contributions under a new subsection created by this bill, AS 39.35.255I, for peace officers and firefighters participating in the defined benefit after June 30th, 2006. There will be a lot of kind of conforming changes throughout this sectional. Section 2 amends AS 37.10.202.
And just to jump in, I think to economize on time, especially I think members have the sectional, I think you can skip the statutory cites.
That would be great. Okay. So Section 2 allows the ARM board to adjust the post-retention, the PRPA amounts and the employee contribution rates. Section 3 adds definitions for peace officers and firefighters. Section 4 has to do with the new health reimbursement arrangement, medical benefit. for peace officers and firefighters in the new tier. Section 5 relates to the retiree health care trust and adds this new group to this trust and says that the Department of Administration may pre-fund this trust. Section 6 also relates to the health care trust and adds this new group.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
This is a bit embarrassing since I'm technically tier 4. I have no idea what my retirement health care is. Is an HRA the part of tier 4 at present?
That is correct, Chair Price Tompkins.
And can I just ask the HRA contemplated in this tier 5 for peace officers, firefighters, is it different? Is it the same or is it different from the HRA in Tier 4?
It is the same as Tier 4.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sorry. Section 7 is a revisor's technical change using a new preferred term for referring to the state retirement system. Section 8 relates to the HRA medical benefits and how they're handled for terminated employees who leave prior to retiring. Section 9 relates to the eligibility for the HRA and adds this new group again. Section 10 adds this new group once again, found in Section 29, allows the administrator to deduct monthly costs for premiums from an HRA after retirement. Section 11 amends this new group and adds this new group to the definition of eligible persons for the HRA. Section 12 lays out the applicability of the defined benefit plan statute to include this new group. So a lot of these are putting this new group into existing statute. And how these are done is for the medical section of this new tier, they're added to the Tier 4 HRA statutes. And for the pension, they are added as a new group under the defined benefit pension.
So if I may, in effect, this bill legally and sort of mechanically is just glomming or piggybacking onto the already extant statutes around HRA. And is tethering to those.
That is correct, yes. Section 13 is a conforming amendment outlining employee contribution rates. And then Section 14, this is the first section that is really one of note that we are going to get to. It creates a new subsection setting the employee contribution rate for peace officers at 8% and allows that to be raised to 10% if determined by the ARM board. Section 15 makes it clear that the total employer contribution remains at 22% for peace officer and firefighter employees, so the aggregate amount, the total amount, is 22%, which is what it is now as well. Section 16 is a technical conforming change to accommodate new subsection I. Section 17 is the same. Section 18 is one of the sections on the slide in front of you. And this is an important one to understand and look at carefully in the bill because it deals with the employer contribution and what portion goes to the employee and what portion goes towards the unfunded liability of the state. Under our new tier, 12% of the employer contribution will go to the employee, and 10% will go to the unfunded liability. And in this section, there's also a new subsection J created that allows the ARM board to increase the employer contribution to the plan if the employee contribution goes up.
A couple questions here to make sure I understand what you were just describing. So a portion of the employer contribution would go to the unfunded liability. Is this the existing unfunded liability from tiers 1 through 3?
That is correct.
So effectively Tier 5, and I realize that to some extent a current employee in Tier 3 who's paying in to the state of Alaska pension is to some extent subsidizing or helping pay into the liabilities that exist for Tier 1 and 2. Is the would Tier 5 beneficiaries be more disproportionately sort of subsidizing the unfunded liability, and forgive me if that's an imprecise choice of words, than, say, DB beneficiaries in previous tiers?
So, Chair Price-Tompkins, I think that it's important to note that this is the employer contribution. So we as employees, our money, our 8% that we are putting in, is going towards our retirement, and that wouldn't change under the new tier. What would change is how the employer allocates their 22%. So currently, the employer still contributes 22%. Only 5% goes to us as the employee. So as a Tier 4 employee, you're receiving a smaller amount of what the employer is putting in to the pot of money. Does that make sense?
I think it does. So Tier 4 right now has no effect on the unfunded liability, because each of us Tier 4 beneficiaries are our own like little planet in the pension solar system, self-contained and having no effect on others. Would the creation of a Tier 5 actually be beneficial to the long-term unfunded liability that the state has? Like, i.e., if we pass this bill and there's a Tier 5, will it reduce the amount of money future legislatures need to pay to close the unfunded liability?
No. It will increase the amount slightly. So, and it will not... It will increase the amount the state is putting toward the unfunded liability annually. So the state will be able to put slightly less toward the unfunded liability. Does that make sense?
Not quite, but I also don't want to bog us down as I struggle to wrap my mind around this.
We have some slides down
great.
The line
let's,
that will explain
let's,
it
yeah,
a little
let's
better,
hold out till then.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for entertaining my dumb questions.
No problem. Thank you. Not at all dumb.
If I might, Ms. Sternberg, just so the committee is aware, the fiscal note reflects, what did you share with them what the fiscal note reflects in terms of that portion toward the unfunded liability that isn't what it otherwise would be?
Yes. So, Chair Price-Tompkins, right now you have an indeterminate fiscal note for this bill, but looking at the fiscal note for the previous version of this bill, HB 79, the state estimated that it would be about $3.5 million less that was paid towards the unfunded liability per year.
By the legislature?
Yes.
Oh, so if I understand what you're saying correctly, the answer to my last question is yes, future legislatures would need to appropriate incrementally less if the projections are accurate, et cetera, if this bill were to pass?
No.
Okay.
No, so this would, quote-unquote, cost the state about $3.5 million. And that cost wouldn't be an actual amount of more money going out. It would be an amount of less being paid to the unfunded liability annually. So the amount of the unfunded liability would not go down as quickly.
But marginal relative to how much we spend on the unfunded liability.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Let's keep going.
If I could maybe help clarify things.
Oh, yeah, please, Mr. Puckett, proceed.
Jim Puckett with Division of Retirement and Benefit to the Chair and the committee. All the tiers in the public employees retirement system are valued separately by our actuary on an annual basis. And then the actuary consolidates to produce a single normal cost and a past service rate for the entire plan. So in other words, the employee contribution in tiers 1, 2, and 3 are different than the employee contribution for tier 4, and also would be for tier 5 if it passes. And each of them also, they do contribute, the employer's part of it, they do contribute toward the unfunded liabilities. Those of us that are tier 4, part of the employer's contribution, a certain percentage is going towards the unfunded liability in the defined benefit path. But like I say, if all of that is valued separately annually and then consolidated, and the actuaries will create a single normal cost and a single service rate for the entire plan. And so I need to wrap my head a little bit about this new tier, if it's actually going to be contributing more toward the unfunded liability. It's possible. I just have not confirmed that myself.
Thank you, Mr. Puckett. And also want to note that Representative Tarr joined us in person at 128. And Representative Tarr, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Puckett, so if we're thinking about each of these sort of cascading tiers all contributing to the unfunded liability, would it be accurate to think that each successive tier became less liberal in the benefit offered, even under a defined benefit? Because my understanding is there were changes in terms of how many years required for service, for example, between the tiers. So each successive tier gets less generous, if you will, so that the newest tiers proportionally may be contributing only because of the difference in the benefit.
Jim Puckett with Division of Retirement Benefit, and I'm sorry I didn't catch the name of...
This is Representative Tarr.
Oh, okay, thank you. I thought I recognized the voice, but I just wasn't positive. You are correct that the benefits have probably been lessened by the consecutive tiers. That was an effort on the part of past legislators to reduce the cost. Mm-hmm. It became clear, I think about a 1984 legislator, that Tier 1 was really going to be too expensive for the state, and that's when they went through the motions of creating Tier 2. A decade later, they did that with Tier 2, going to Tier 3, and then a decade later, they did again with Tier 4. All of those efforts were to reduce the cost of the state and the employers that participate in the retirement systems. And as it was pointed out earlier in the meeting, the unfunded liability was increasing. The legislator, a number of years ago, made this $3 billion contribution to the TERS and then one to the PERS. As far as the amount of the contribution from each of those tiers toward the unfunded liability, I don't have that number handy. And I can get that if you would like to have that. But yes, in effort to reduce the cost to the state and the participating employers, benefits have been reduced with each tier.
And it was just for me, Mr. Chairman, like the logic to follow in the questioning you had of how then proportionally each successive tier potentially contributes more to the unfunded liability because, right, overall their benefit has been lessened. So there's like proportionally more to go to the unfunded liability in each successive tier.
Yeah, and I think at a future date, I'm sort of morbidly curious the sort of anatomy of the unfunded liability and how much of it is proportionally attributable to Tier 1 versus Tier 2 versus Tier 3. But we can save that for a future date. Representative Eastman, a question.
Bad joke in there.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, to clarify, I just want to make sure I'm not confused on this. If the state were to find a pot of money and eliminate the unfunded liability, would that have any effect whatsoever on, say, the folks in Tier 4? Would they see a greater benefit or less expense in some way, or is that entirely firewalled and separate?
I'm not sure if you were asking me or somebody else.
Mr. Puckett, maybe we can run with you if you're willing to take the question.
No, I'm happy to do that. Jim Puckett with Retirement Benefit, through the share to Representative Eastman. The benefits are locked in statute, and as Representative Josephson noted earlier in this meeting, they have a constitutional protection, so they cannot be diminished. If the state was to find a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and they applied all of that to the unfunded liability, and let's say we no longer had an unfunded liability that made it 100% funded, then what would happen next would be that the contribution rate from the employers would most likely be reduced. There would not be an actuarial necessity to charge the rate that we are being charged right now. And just as an example, all PERS employers are contributing 22%. That would cap, I believe, in 2008, but don't quote me on that year. I might be off. When the PERS went into it's a result of the Tier 4 going into effect, and it was a compromise on how to handle the added expense at that time with the unfunded liability. You cannot reduce the benefit, but actuarially, if there was no unfunded liability that we had to finance, it would be most likely that the contribution amount would be reduced actuarially.
Follow up?
Thank you very much for that. That's helpful. So I understand from that the employer would not have to pay as much money, but the employee or the retiree would not really be impacted either way. So hopefully I got that right. But my follow-up question is, and maybe you don't have the answers available, but I would be very interested to understand this bill. So I would want to know exactly what the unfunded liability is now, and on our current trajectory, when that would be paid off. And then on our new trajectory, should we adopt the hybrid plan, you know, what the difference is between our current trajectory of paying it off, and now it sounds like it would be paid off a little bit later. And then to try and get some kind of number to assign the difference in cost, obviously, if we're carrying debt or something else for a longer period of time, you know, there's some costs involved in that. So trying to understand what that delta is, what that farther down the road price tag is that we're trying to talk about. Thank you.
Ms. Sorenberg and Representative Justison, if either of you have comment to that question, you can also pick that up, because I think that'll be an important question the committee is interested in at a future date.
Representative Christ Tompkins, I don't have a succinct answer to that question at this time. I'd like to work with the Division of Retirement and Benefits, because that's a fairly complicated question. Representative Eastman.
Thank you.
Great. Maybe we can bookmark it for down the road. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was looking at this commissioned employee engagement survey. As of December, it was in the package. And I'm just wondering context. As I look at, what page is it? Page 7 in that document, there's a pie chart of the results of the survey. And I note that defined benefit retirement package was 9% of the surveyed respondees. They apparently highlighted that. There's a whole bunch of other stuff the weighting is much higher. Improved department leadership and culture, more training, increased staffing, improve administrative processes, which looks like, gosh, I don't know, about 64% or so. I'm just is what I'm wondering, just big picture, I always like to start there, is this actually the lever that will improve our retention and our hiring?
Representative Kaufman, through the chair. This is a lever that will improve retention and recruitment. It is something that we have heard from individuals in the public safety field about, and similar pieces of legislation have been looked at for a number of years. And we will look, and the recruitment and retention cost is very high. There's a presentation following ours from Mr. Miranda and Mr. Lozano, who are from the Professional Firefighters Association, and they'll look a little bit more in depth to that. But yes, there is a big want for this. This is something people are citing in their letters of support to us, saying that it looks much more attractive for me to go to Washington or Colorado or somewhere where I can get better retirement. So it is maybe not the only way we can improve retention and recruitment, but it's a major way we can do it.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair. It just looks like by this survey, it looks like one of the minor levers, and I just wonder what else we could be doing that would actually, you know, move employment satisfaction more solidly and perhaps quicker, and the cost of improving department leadership and culture, that may be a bigger bang for the buck if we could find a way to do that. And again, I'm just quoting what's referenced here. That's 21%, and then in the other category, there is alternate schedule options, employee recognition program. Those are things that are if not free, they're pretty low cost. And so I think those need to be highlighted. If what we're trying to do is to attract is one thing, to retain, that's really what you want. So I think the retention lever, there's some pretty powerful things that are literally on the table right here that we should focus upon. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair to Representative Kaufman. Looking at the pie chart that you've identified, or charts, of all of the public safety and fire employees in the state, the ones that let me first be clear that there's not much separation of opinion here, and I don't want to overstate this. But in fact, there is incredible passion about this issue, and you will hear it during public testimony. But the state troopers, and I hope I'm not out of my lane on this, but the state troopers have expressed some concern. Now, note, their public employee union doesn't oppose the bill, but they've expressed some concern that the benefits, and this should actually provide you, ironically, some comfort, are not great enough. And the reason is, you and I, Representative Price Tompkins, you more than me, theoretically, if the public would have us, we could stay here and work as long as Senator Hoffman, and we wouldn't wear down, and he's going to keep going because he's able to do it. State troopers can't do that. They have to at least move to a desk job, if not retire. And this plan won't let them draw retirement until they're 55. And what we've learned is that state troopers begin their service for reasons I can't really explain, but they begin their service at a younger age than other, for example, JPD, Sitka Police Department. Now, this is on the average, right? So part of the response, I think, to Representative Kaufman is, of all of the different sectors that might want this benefit, and again, I submit to you that the vast majority want it. They are asking for it. And that's why you'll see that legislature after legislature, it's filed. The state troopers wish that they could draw retirement, for example, at age 45. But The positive part of that, and here's the irony, is the plan, and we have an expert, Mr. Fornia, who is known to many legislators in the building at this point because he's presented so many times, the plan is solvent. And it's got all of these triggers and mechanisms to stay solvent. So I would love to return to a tier one for groups that want to be able to retire and draw earlier. But it puts us at risk of going back into the unfunded liability lane. So I think that's part of the response here is the graph that Representative Kaufman refers to, at least if it's the one at page 11-7. I'd have to look through this, but essentially that may be part of the reason why there are these other wedges of the pie that look like they might add up to a better answer for employee morale.
Thank you. And I think at this time maybe we can hold questions and complete the sectional and I think maybe all the slides that the sponsor's office has prepared and take up questions at this time. I know we have invited testimony today. It may end up being that we'll really dig into that at a future hearing. But for now, let's aim to sort of get a good understanding at a high level of the bill itself. And back to you, Ms. Sorenberg. I think we're at Section 18, if I recall correctly.
Thank you, Chair Kreis-Tompkins. For the record, Elise Sorenberg. I believe we're at Section 19 of the bill. So, Section 19 is a conforming section relating to an employer's contribution for medical benefits for the new tier. Section 20 is a conforming amendment which outlines the years of service requirement to become eligible for the retirement benefits under the defined benefit retirement plan. Section 21, and this is another one of those important levers in this bill, says that anyone who is in this new tier can retire at age 55 with 20 years of service or at age 60 with 5 years of service. And the representative already kind of spoke to why that's important. Section 22 concerns alternative benefits for elected public officials, and it adds this new tier to the list, saying that public officials are not entitled to this new plan under alternative benefits. Section 23 is a conforming amendment concerning the schedule for making the annual PRPA adjustment payment. Section 24 is a conforming amendment concerning the calculation of the PRPA. Section 25, this is another one that you'll see on the slide before you as one of the levers or new features of the bill. This is the post-pension retirement adjustment. This is that part that gives the ARM board the ability to withhold that, and we've already talked about that a little bit. Section 26 is a conforming amendment concerning medical benefits for employees under the defined benefit plan. Section 27 is a conforming amendment concerning major medical insurance coverage for the defined benefit plan. Section 28 is a new subsection that says peace officers participating in the new plan will receive benefits under the HRA. Section 29 is the new section that creates the HRA medical benefits for peace officers and firefighters first participating in this new defined benefit plan. It specifies the eligibility, cost of premiums, and procedures for participation. So this says that these individuals still have the HRA rather than tier 1 through 3 medical. Section 30 is an important section in that it establishes what we're calling the high five rule. And so in tiers 1 through 3,
A pension is determined by a calculation using the 3 high years of salary at the end of someone's career. Our bill would spread it out to 5 years. Section 31 is an amendment, a conforming amendment to the definition of employer to include these individuals in the new tier. 32 is another definition adjustment for normal retirement definition. Section 33 is a conforming amendment regarding the membership in a defined contribution retirement system. Section 34 and is regarding employer contributions to defined contribution retirement plan. Section 35 and 36 are quite lengthy and important. They are sections that are outlining procedures for buy-in. They're uncodified sections. So they're outlining how an individual who is currently in Tier 4 would be able to opt in to the new system. Section 37 adds a new section instructing the DOA commissioner to make conforming regulations. 38 states that Section 37 takes immediately effect immediately, and Section 39 is the effective date. And thank you for your patience on that very long section.
Yeah, just a comment. I think the sectional analysis is exceptionally well written. Thank you. I have a couple of questions about some of those sections, but other questions from the committee? Representative Eastman?
Yes, I just wanted to get a clear understanding of the significance of the date, 2006, in various portions of the bill, and what exactly that means.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, 2006 is when the Tier 4 plan went into effect. So throughout the bill, language is added saying that if you are in a defined benefit plan after 2006, because that doesn't exist right now, these things apply to you.
Got it. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So then that's separating Tier 4 from the other 3 tiers, more or less?
Through the chair, it's showing that there's a new tier that is a defined benefit tier that exists after 2006.
Follow up. And so in the case where someone is opting into the hybrid, how far back in the calendar can they go to receive credit under the hybrid for previous work already completed?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, anyone who is in Tier 4 can buy in to the new tier. It will be significantly more expensive for individuals to buy in if they've served for longer. So if you started your career in 2006, it will cost you more to buy into the new tier, and you may not get credit for all of your years of service because it's calculated by the ARM board at a certain rate. And I believe that is found in sections 35 and 36 of the bill, speaks to how they'll determine those rates. But there is a percentage of buy-in, and then there's additionally an annual factor that there's an annual adjustment after that. I don't know if that makes any sense. So there's a base percentage and then an annual percentage that you add on to that.
Thank you. Final follow-up. So in this case, if I had started working June 30th, 2006 and was Tier 4 the whole time and worked full-time, would all those years be potentially eligible, or is there something else that's determining? You mentioned not all those years might be eligible. What if it's not the calendar date, what is it that would be determining? I mean, if I've worked full time, is that all good, or are we talking about somebody who took a year off or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, they're all eligible for purposes of running the calculation. But if you, under your hypothetical, started in 2006, the day after the effective date of the creation of Tier 4, you would have been employed, for example, at the Department of Public Safety for exactly 15 years, give or take, but you wouldn't get 15 years of service under the Tier 5. There would be a delta that you'd have to basically purchase the remainder of the year. So someone at R&B Retirement and Benefits would say, you know, we're going to transfer, now don't hold me to this number, but it's going to be something like 11, 12 years out of the 15. But again, that shouldn't come as a surprise, because the very point of this bill is to improve the retiree's financial position when they retire. So, as I said, relative to another bill, that I'm working on, unrelated bill, that you're going to see some cost difference, but mostly this is a reflection of, it's mostly a reflection of the fact that you can't draw your retirement as soon as you'd like. There's going to be these other triggers, so that's going to reduce things if the ARM board doesn't see the returns it wants. But importantly, you don't get the medical that Tier 1 through 3 get. So those are all factors that make it so that we can build an attractive plan that would keep people here in Alaska during the pendency of their entire career. And by the way, just if I might follow up, one other item I noticed on Representative Kaufman's question. In the slice, the pie chart you see at 7, rather pages 6, 7, and 8, the question asked, I think, is important. So, for example, in one of them, one of the surveys, the question is, what would be the three most important reasons you'd want to continue working for the department? In others, it's about how you would improve your employment at this minute in the department. So, for example, when asked what would be good to retain people in the department, the return to defined benefit goes from 9% to 23%. So, and that's a much, you know, that's 2.5 times the 9%. So you see its significance rise as you ask the question regarding retention and retirement. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tarr, and then after Representative Tarr's question, let's complete the remaining slides in the sponsor's office presentation. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be a better question for the invited testimony. I'm just curious. The part of 55 years with 20 years of service makes sense. The 60 years with 5 years seems sort of like overly generous in comparison. And I'm just kind of like, is there some thinking behind that, or does it mirror something else? Would love to understand that more.
I'm actually going to piggyback on that question, because I literally had written down the same thing. I was like, oh, can I, theoretically one could become a firefighter at age 55, yeah, do 5 years, and then you have a DB pension for the rest of your life. I'm just sort of curious how that all squares up.
Chair Christ-Tompkins and Representative Tarr, this would be for someone who did not last in the system until the age of 55 necessarily. So this would be for someone who worked 5 or more years in the system and was vested. Does that make sense? They just could not access their retirement until the age of 60 rather than until the age of 55.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Okay, so under that scenario, someone could have worked 5 years when they were 25 to 30, then they've left state service. They're eligible at age 60 with just that 5 years of service.
I believe that's correct. Could I call a lifeline of Mr. Miranda, who's online?
Yeah, Mr. Miranda, welcome. Please put yourself on record, and if you can speak to this 5 years, age 60 question that we're grappling with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Miranda. I'm the president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. I think if I understand the question correctly, The answer is yes. In theory, if someone were to work to have 5 years of service and then leave their public service job in the state, when they turned age 60, they could collect that 2% of final average salary for those 5 years that they serve after age 60. So that would most likely be quite a small benefit, but that is correct. Does that clarify the question, Mr. Chair?
For me, thank you.
I think so, and I think Representative Eastman has a brief comment on the subject, and then we'll proceed with the slides.
And you know, feel free to point me to some place that's already written down. I'm just trying to make sure that I can appropriately weigh the difference between someone who has, you know, done 20 years of service and someone who's done 5 years of service, and they both, you know, start collecting benefits at age 60, and just trying to get a clear understanding of what the differences are.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, if you have this purple sheet in your file, you can. So that benefit, that is not something new we're adding. The calculation is not something new we're adding to the bill. It's something that's currently found in AS 39.35.370C. So for your first 10 years, you get a 2% benefit calculation, and then after that, that goes up to 2.5%.
Thank you.
Let's proceed with the slides.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to go through these fairly quickly because we have spoken about most of the issues that are on the slides I'm going to go through. So this is just many years of work are encapsulated in this legislation. These are versions of this bill going back to the 28th legislature. The gentlemen who are online have been involved in this process for a number of years and are very knowledgeable.
And Ms. Thornbrook, maybe at the end of the presentation, just as to the slide three, if you or Representative Josephson could speak to the differences that exist in House Bill 55 vis-a-vis House Bill 79 from the 31st legislature, small as they might be.
I'll do that very briefly. It is literally one definition. It is the name of a trust fund that was changed. It was a conversation that had gone on between a previous legislative aide and the Division of Retirement and Benefits. So it was a few lines, a very small change that was the name of a trust fund.
Thank you.
So none of the mechanics of the bill are different at all. Okay, so this is the details of what Tier 4 currently looks like. It is a 401A made up of 13% payroll. 8% of that comes from the employee, 5% from the employer. You get the HRA, which is 3% of the average PERS salary. Note that that's for all PERS, not specific to public safety. So that's a lower salary amount than, say, what a public safety employee would likely be making. You get Medicare. So one thing that there is Medicare coverage with 25 years of service for public safety or at Medicare eligible age. Disability in Tier 4 is very similar to disability in Tier 3. It should be noted that both the disability and the HRA are looked at each year by the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And then this bottom piece here is very important. Most municipal employees are not covered by Social Security or SBS. They just have the 401A. So SBS is something that the state created, and it went into effect in 1979, and it's the state's opt-out for Social Security. So we, as Tier 4 employees, have our Tier 4 401A and an SBS. And that gives us a little more security than a lot of municipal employees who are lacking that additional SBS. So here's a look at three different showings of inadequacy for Tier 4.
William Fornia, who we referenced earlier and has done a lot of analysis on this tier, noted that tier four would replace 31% of someone's income after 25 years. Department of Administration estimated 38.5% after using a 30-year time frame. And then there was a really, really great presentation last year in House Finance where Bob Mitchell, the CIO of the state, put a probability of a 25-year public safety employee replacing 70% of income in 30 years at only 6%. And a 30-year employee, that probability was 22%. So a lot of issues we've already touched upon. There's recruitment difficulties, some major retention costs that I'll address a little more thoroughly in other slides, and we have a whole slideshow from our invited testimony on that topic. Workers' compensation costs have gone up, and that's due to older workforces, people not staying in state. And then there's been operational capabilities and unforeseen costs, and unforeseen costs include things like understaffing leading to overtime payments that municipalities end up covering the costs for, or the state if it's a state public safety employee. Okay, so we've already touched on most of these, but here's the cost containment measures of HB 55. The benefits are reduced significantly from tier three. The plan is built on more conservative assumptions with reasonable costs in mind. It requires a steady level of contribution from both the employee and employer, and remember, both of those contributions can go up. It also includes mechanisms for dealing with adverse experiences. Those are those levers we've been talking about. And it shares risk between employees, employers, and retirees. Everyone has a bit of skin in the game, right? Everyone will take a little bit of a hit if the plan goes below 90% funded. So benefit reductions to tier five, there's no pre-Medicare coverage. So it's just that HRA. There's no, and this is as compared to tier three defined benefits, I should say. There's no cost of living allowance for pensions. The final calculation is that high five as opposed to high three. And the thought behind that is there's this theory that people do something called spiking, where they will try to get a higher salary for their last 3 years.
It's not a theory.
But, yeah. Yes. And again, this goes to requires a minimum of 55 years with 20 years of service to collect full benefits. So it was built. So here's some of the, and we've already talked about most of this, built on a lower than expected rate of return, requires steady contributions for both employees and employers, allows the employee contribution to go up to 10%, but will not fall below 8%, allows the PRPA inflation proofing to be withheld, again, if you fall below that 90% magic number. Replicates tier four defined contribution medical and tries to maintain reasonable employer costs. So this is a slide that will kind of touch on the costs of, and this is, I will start off by saying they're referring to HB 79G, which was the version of the bill in House Finance last legislature. So these two pie charts would kind of show you the difference in what the state would be paying towards the unfunded liability. And the part I have in bold is kind of the most important takeaway. So because the percentage being deposited to the DB trust decreases from 12.2% to 10%, additional state contribution increases. So that's where the cost, quote unquote, cost of the bill is coming from. It's that decrease to the DB trust. And that decrease was estimated last year. Again, this is HB 79 numbers, not HB 55 numbers. The new actuarial analysis has not been done by the division yet. Their estimate was that that would be about $3,500,000 annually. That would be not paid towards those the DB trust, but this is just looking at costs of training on employees and turnover. The far left is if 1% of employees left, middle is if 2% of employees left, and to the last column over is if 3% of employees left.
DOT? Is that department referring to Department of Transportation? An estimated cost for DOC?
Airport, Police, and Fire.
Airport, Police, and Fire. Okay. And what is DOC?
Department of Corrections.
Okay.
Andy Josephson, for the record, as to the DOC employees, the turnover there is just horrendous. It's just, it's, you'll hear about it, but it's, I don't know if it's 40% churn every 5 years, but it's you're going to hear numbers like that.
Sure. I think that's the last slide, not mistaken. And a quick question I have. I mean, I really appreciate the cost benefit that we're seeing on slide 11. I think the problem I have with the analysis is that when these, you know, projected pound-wise, if, you know, penny complicated policy proposals are putting forward, it seems like almost never there's the actual follow through and reduction of the prevented or preempted costs. It's the reason I really like social impact bonds, is it actually codifies that relationship of long-term savings and requires them to materialize. And I mean, I get that there's good rationale behind this basis, and I am inclined to be supportive of this bill. It would just be really terrific if we actually had the ability to have budget decrements in DPS, DOT, and DOC 5 years down the road, because literally, truly, there are these decreased costs that materialize. I just have very little faith that the 35th Alaska legislature is going to have that experience if we pass HB 55 this year. But if there was a way to make that happen, that would be very exciting. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate this slide. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So in the bottom right-hand corner, we're talking about turnover. I assume that the 19 employees is part of the DOC component, and then the 31 employees is DPS, and then the 44 is DOT. And so it's saying that for the majority, I guess 870 of the 1,355 state employees we're talking about fall into that 1% turnover category. And I'm, you know, just looking at the numbers, that looks pretty low. What sort of turnover are we anticipating for that component with the introduction of the hybrid plan? Are we trying to get that 1% down to 0.5, or help me understand, you know, where that 1% is coming from and where it's going?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, these are just estimates saying that if we lose 1% of our total state public safety workforce, this is how much we're paying for training costs for those employees we're losing. The actual amounts are higher than 1, 2, or 3%.
Thank you. Yes, that helps.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. And this is a 1% per year?
Yes, this is just looking at annual costs.
Okay.
Representative Eastman.
I'm curious, now since we are, you know, promoting the hybrid plan as a way of becoming, in one sense, more competitive for recruitment, retention, whatnot, where does Alaska currently fall in terms of our competitiveness to those other states and localities that we might be losing people to?
Through the chair, we're not very competitive. I was wondering, maybe Mr. Miranda could speak to that more eloquently.
And I think in a future hearing, we'll hear from Mr. Lozano, Mr. Miranda in depth, and my understanding is that they can sort of present the authoritative analysis on Alaska's comparative competitiveness or lack of competitiveness and attention issues. Yeah. Representative Eastman.
Just to get it out there, I know we may not have time today, but a question that in looking over the bill that I've had is, so we're talking about these 1,400 employees out of the 3,000, and I'm just wondering, from what I gather, up to all 3,000 could potentially be participants in the hybrid plan, but maybe most of them won't because it just doesn't, pan out dollar for dollar for them. But what is the liability if we've done some legal analysis for someone outside of those 3,000 saying, hey, I'm a state employee, I want access to this plan too for whatever reason, what's the legal liability if they take the state to court and say, I should fit in as 3,000 number one or some greater number, in which case I'm trying to figure out, are we looking at the potential for more than 3,000? Or are we very clear that there's no legal liability to the state that could expand that number? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm not a lawyer, this gentleman is, but I think what's important to note is that public safety retirement is already treated differently, legally speaking. It's already based on a 20-year standard. In different tiers, there has been different percentages that these individuals pay in, different benefits they get that other public employees do not get. That's a very surface level answer, but these people are already treated differently. These employees already have different retirement benefits in statute.
Yeah, through the chair, I don't think there's any liability at all. I mean, obviously, we contract with different bargaining units differently anyway for different benefits. I would say, Representative Eastman, that there are, with good cause, there's real concern about the lack of defined benefits for teachers, for example. Spill prevention response has come up recently in a hearing, and any number of other agencies. However, my own position as to this bill is to first see whether this class of workers can secure this benefit. And, but understand, as you know, that once the bill is given to the House clerk and the Speaker assigns it, it's at, I'm one guy, and I can't, I can try to direct the process, but I can't always foretell where it's going to go. My bill is about getting first responders a defined benefit so that they stay in the state and that these numbers that you see here on the cost of employing them, so we're not, we're not basically doing the work for other states who, take our workers and benefit from that.
Thank you very much.
I think that also could double as a good closing statement for today. Thank you, Representative Josephson and Ms. Sorenberg, for an excellent bill presentation. We'll take this up at a later date. There's a lot in the docket, but hopefully, especially when subcommittees wrap up, we can really dig into these pieces of legislation in earnest. I also want to note that next week's schedule is noticed, and there is a meeting on Saturday with bills previously heard noted, and I think we can maybe take that as a game time decision for the committee, depending on our sort of pace of progress next week and other factors. So my office will keep you all apprised there. And I want to thank Tom with LIO and Sophia, who's online with House Records, and our committee aide Jeff Stepp for facilitating today's hearing. And thank you all for making the time on a Saturday. And at 2:28 p.m., we are adjourned.